Welcome to Jerusalem Unplugged, the only podcast dedicated to Jerusalem, its history, and its people. Your host, Roberto Mazza, will bring you guests discussing their relationship with the Holy City. A journey through history, society, feelings, and hopes for the future. Follow the podcast on all social media platforms at Jerusalem Unplugged.
Welcome to Jerusalem Unplugged, the podcast dedicated to Jerusalem, its history and its people. I'm your host, Roberto Mazza, and today my guest is Dr. Yair Wallach. Yair is senior lecturer at SOAS, at the School of Oriental and African Studies in London, and is the author, and acclaimed author, I would say, of A City in Fragment, Urban Text in Modern Jerusalem. Yair, welcome.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be on the podcast.
As you probably already know, the first question, and the only common question to all of my guests is, Yair, what is your Jerusalem? In other words, what is your connection with the city?
So I was born in Jerusalem, and I grew up in the city or not far from the city. I went to university there, my first degree. So I spent most of my life in Jerusalem or not far from it. Up until I finished my first degree, and I came to the UK for my MA and postgraduate studies. And since then, I've been here. My family and friends, many of them are still in Jerusalem, so that's the connection. But I also ended up writing about Jerusalem and teaching about Jerusalem, which was unexpected for me. So it's an ongoing relationship.
Now, you just published this very I would say, powerful book about Jerusalem, acclaimed. You know, it has become sort of a buzz, not just amongst the people working on Jerusalem, but also through social media and media. But I want to move to more the personal connection with the city. There is a very powerful image and story at the very beginning of the book. It's you on the roof of a railway station in Jerusalem. How did you start thinking about working on Jerusalem? You're talking about you walking around the city. So I was wondering, what did young Yair Wallach saw in Jerusalem?
So I have to say, I mean, this is goes back to my PhD, and I was initially reluctant to work on Jerusalem. I came from the direction of textuality, text, and I wanted to write something about the modern history of text, and I wanted to write about Arabic and Hebrew, but I didn't know what form exactly it would take. And it was going to be about text in the city. So the kind of text that we see around us every day, but we half read, half notice, half not notice at all. And that was the idea in general. And I thought Cairo, Haifa, and so forth. And then my PhD supervisor at the time said, why don't you write about Jerusalem? And I was taken aback. And of course, because, you know, nobody wants to write about the place they came from. It's like, we're too familiar with this. It's boring and so forth. But then I considered it, and I thought, actually, this is a very good suggestion, because from the very beginning, this was going to be a comparative project. I wanted to look at transformation of Arabic and Hebrew with modernity. And the benefit of Jerusalem, it's not a very big city, but it allows to do this comparative work in such a microcosm. That's one thing. And the second, it had longer tradition. So in a way, if I was going to Haifa is a, you know, it's a 18th century village that becomes into a town, becomes into a bigger town, and so forth. But you cannot compare it to Jerusalem, where you have, in terms of text, in terms of inscriptions, you have millennia of inscribing onto the landscape of the city. And that is very important. And Jerusalem is very, very well documented. And that's the other thing. I mean, it's, you know, it's one of the places that when you have photography, and when photography is invented, or in the same year, you have photographers arriving in Jerusalem starting to take pictures. So just in terms of photographic archive, it's a remarkable richness there that I wouldn't have in any other place. So in that sense, I thought actually this is a potentially very interesting location. What I didn't realize is that by doing the research, I will change the way I look at the city. And I think that was the big gift of studying it and eventually writing the book, is that I thought I knew Jerusalem. I had these kind of conceptions of what the city is. I came to reread it in a completely different light. And that was for me a good gift to receive. And in some ways, I think that my current project is not specifically on Jerusalem, and I'll probably move on from Jerusalem to other areas. But for me, that was a good way to say hello and farewell to the city that I thought I knew so well, and I rediscovered through this research.
Can I ask you what kind of differences you noticed, you know, moving from Yair Wallach, the resident, the person, the individual that grew in the city, and your scholarly work? What kind of Jerusalem changed, or what your perception of the city changed?
I mean, the big thing was reevaluating the modern history of the city, the late Ottoman and the British Mandatory period. And for that, also reinterpreting Jerusalem of today. I think what is meant in concrete terms is that I would go around places which I knew very well, but because I started seeing them through the archival sources, through the diaries and memoirs I was reading, suddenly I started hearing voices. The ghosts started speaking to me, and they told stories that I was not familiar with and were surprising. So the same kind of urban fabric, which I was extremely well familiar with, suddenly shifted in my head, was reconfigured into something else. I mean, the best example is Jaffa Gate. And Jaffa Gate is, so for me, it was the portal of the old city. And, you know, it has this kind of large square in front of it, and there's the promenade along the walls, which I knew very well. A relative of mine was in charge of the putting the illumination of the city walls that makes it so striking in the night. So this is all such a familiar part of my childhood, to see the city walls and to see Jaffa Gate and to buy the, you know, the bagels, the Jerusalem kak in Jaffa Gate with the za'atar. All this is very familiar. Suddenly I was reading that this was the center of town, and that there was these rows and rows of shops and cafes and banks and photographer studios that were there. And I read various people I was reading, Gad Frumkin, Khalil Sakakini, and they all hang out in those places which are no longer there. It's all destroyed, yeah? And there's not even a relic. There's nothing there to indicate that there was something there that was not just another neighborhood. This was the heart of the city. And for them, this was the promise of tomorrow. And, you know, hearing these people in my head while kind of walking this promenade, which obliterates them and obliterates their memory, that was a very unsettling experience, and one that really kind of in a way, you know, you walk on familiar ground, and the carpet is swept underneath your feet. You feel you know this place, but you don't really know this place. And suddenly, it's completely different from what you thought. And the same thing is going, you know, the road that is now takes you underneath the promenade and takes you out of around Damascus Gate. And in a way, going through that, under that part, and thinking about this part of the city was a very, you know, it's just a very strange experience. And that kind of made me think that the way we think about Jerusalem, and I think there's very clear lines in everybody's, you know, Jerusalemites have a very clear invisible lines of Jewish areas, Arab areas, and the you know, the tiny international enclaves. And these lines were basically, again, swept aside to something else, to some other kind of Jerusalem that was not some kind of ancient city, but rather a very modern one. And when you read these memoirs, you know, they are incredibly modern. I mean, you know, in your first episode, when your interview with Selim Tamari, he talked about Hassan Tourjeman. And when you read Hassan, I mean, his voice is so fresh. He sounds like a 20-year-old today. You don't feel like this is some kind of the hallowed past or anything. You feel that this is someone who is really excited by the promise of technology and the tomorrow, etc. I mean, there's something so fresh. And again, I mean, I think about Hassan, I think about him going to buy his European hat in near Jaffa Gate. He's sitting in the cafes there, etc. And I felt a connection to these people, and they were all gone. Their descendants, in the case of Tourjeman, displaced, but the places are gone. And that, again, I mean, I think it was very, very strange feeling and a strange feeling. But that made me think that, you know, that we can think of other ways. We can think of other Jerusalemite futures rather than the ones that we are very familiar with, the present. So in that sense, it was also a liberating moment that Jerusalem does not have to be a captive of its perception of its past. It can actually use the past to break free of this kind of heaviness which we associate with it.
I would agree with the fact that there's so many people just looking at Jerusalem through the lenses of its past, but the past that is often biblical or oriented to satisfy claims or what they believe. So I don't want to go into that, but I want to ask you something, because you are one of the few people that worked on one of these Jerusalemite figures roaming around the city between the late Ottoman period and the early British era, which is Gad Frumkin. We know a lot about Hassan Tourjeman that you mentioned, Wasil Juwairiya, Sakakini, and other individuals. What I always found fascinating about Gad Frumkin is he wrote extensively, never translated into English. And in fact, you are one of the few people that took chunks of his diary and memoirs and eventually, you know, made it available to a larger audience. Can you tell us who was Gad Frumkin and why such an important individual in that transitional period?
So Gad Frumkin, born in the late 19th century, to a Hasidic family. His father was a Lubavitch Hasid, a man with means, an educated man, that settled very close to the Sarai, the new Sarai, that was later the Muslim orphanage. And they lived very, very close. So he lived very close to the center of power in what is now today, you know, the Muslim quarter, but it's, Frumkin calls it Al-Wad neighborhood, because this is the Al-Wad, Mahalit Al-Wad. And the father came from Tsarist Russia. became a publisher, had a you know, a print shop in his house, and that was the main source of income. So he had a newspaper, Chabatzelet, but he's also a public activist in the Jewish Ashkenazi community, involved with the municipality, involved with various forms of charity, has a lots of businesses, trading activities, small initiatives, a prolific and active man, Israel Dov, the father of Frumkin. So his father was an Ashkenazi migrant, again, very well connected to the Muslim elites, to various Christian families, to various, you know, Jewish diasporic organizations and so forth. And Gad grew up in that context. You know, their landlords and neighbors were the Hosseini family. But he grew up primarily in a Jewish environment, privately educated, but then started writing for his father's newspaper. And he was a very ambitious man from the very beginning. I mean, he was someone with grand hopes. And around the 1908 revolution, that crystallizes too. He understands that there's new possibilities. So he is the first one to announce on the revolution in his father's newspaper, according to the memoir. He goes to the Ismail Be Hosseini, who was the kind of censor, and he was in charge of the education in the district, and asks for permission to break the news about the revolution. And Ismail Hosseini says to him, "Are you sure you want to do this? You know, it might go the other way. Don't be rushed," and so forth. And we know that Hosseinis were more skeptical about the revolution than the Khaldis. We know these stories. But he is very much a believer of the revolution, and he sees the opportunities there. And that's also the break with his father. He thinks that Jews should seize on the moment and use this to promote themselves, whether it's through business or through working in the Ottoman parliament and so forth. So he goes to Istanbul to study law. His big hope is to become an MP in the Ottoman parliament. Comes back to Palestine just before the war, and becomes a lawyer, involved with the Ottomans, has very good connections with Jamal Pasha and others. When the war ends, he is there as someone who is, on the one hand, part of the city, part of the local elite, if you want, excellent connections with the Arab elite and so forth. But on the other hand, his father-in-law is a big Zionist, Aaron Eisenberg from Rehovot, and he is familiar with the Zionists. So the Zionists come to him, and Chaim Weizmann says, "We want you in the courts. We want you to be a judge." And they push him to take a position of a judge, and within 2 years, he's on the bench of the Supreme Court in Jerusalem. For a young man, this is a meteoric rise. And as one of the justices of the Supreme Court, I think he's effectively the most senior Jew in the Palestine government. We have other Jews in senior positions in the education department, in the trade department, and so forth, but never quite as high, I think. Although this is a judiciary, this is not the government of Palestine. Nonetheless, it's a very, very esteemed position. It's one of the is also influential. So for 28 years, from 1920 till 1948, he's in that position. And within that, he has a lot of power within the Yishuv. He has a lot of power and connection with the Arab elite. And he is very pivotal to various initiatives, which And quite abruptly in 1948, when the State of Israel is established, and for out of caution, he steps down from the court because he does not know what's going to come next, but he expects to be part of the Supreme Court when it's reestablished. But he's effectively sacked or kicked out of the court. So you have someone who is the most senior Jew in the Palestine government and in the judiciary that is then not even given a place in the Supreme Court, let alone to be the head of the Supreme Court. And that is because the Ministry of Justice is a German Jew that came much later. And the German Jews do not like Frumkin. For them, he's kind of a native. He's an Oriental Jew, even if he's Ashkenazi. And they invent a story that he took bribes and use it as an excuse to kick him out. He when he learns about this, he's outraged, and there's some kind of committee that clears his name. And that's the story. He dies not much later. So he writes the memoir in a way to clear his name, not explicitly. Yeah? I mean, the story of the bribe does not appear there, but in a way to defend his reputation and to show to the Hebrew reader his role in the construction of the Yishuv and setting up the ground and his illustrious career and so forth. So in a way, I have the memoir is really written for Hebrew readers to and for Zionist readers. So it's written to defend his record in that sense. But at the same time, if you read it carefully and you need to read it against the grain, you can see a lot of his disagreements with the Zionist establishment. And you can see that he came from a different perspective. And to a large extent, that different perspective also resulted in the fact that he was excluded from the Supreme Court. Now, what I found interesting, this is a well-known source. I was not by no means the first one to use it. But what we have, people who used it usually in a very narrow way on the political history in which Frumkin was involved, his connection with Haj Amin Husseini, perhaps the initiative of the Five that he was involved for negotiations. Even then, it's not much has been written. And a little bit more than that, it was taken as a social history source to a degree by Yoshua Ben Arye and others, but in a minimal way. And very few have written about Frumkin the man. The only person who have written about him in detail other than me, I think, was Nathan Brun, who wrote about his legal career and the story of his exclusion from the Supreme Court. And I met Nathan Brun, the late Nathan Brun, and we talked about these things. I thought actually he deserved a more careful study. First of all, the memoir is fascinating in terms of his eye for detail. You know, the detail of the Sarai. I don't think we have such another detail of how the Sarai works in around 1890. You know, how a document goes from one room to the other. You know, how the clerks sit and who do you have to, and what stamp you use and all of these things. I'm not familiar with another account for Jerusalem. And he goes street by street in terms of what shops were there and who sold what. And, you know, this guy was grumpy and this guy was welcoming and so forth. So in that sense, it's a remarkable source. But it's also a remarkable source of on the kind of trajectories that the late Ottoman and British Mandate period allowed. And a way to think of these Jewish communities, and not through the lens of Zionism, and not through this kind of dismissive category, the old issue, which is an ideological category that's designed to make them sound, you know, irrelevant. You know, the old Yeshuv, they are the people of the past. This is the way the Zionists refer to the Jewish communities that were already there in Palestine before they came. Of course, the story is much more complicated, but it's actually not a very useful way because it actually masks such a difference between them. And through someone like Frumkin, we can see these people on their own terms, not as part of some pejorative old Yishuv, but part of communities in a process of transformation.
We are going to take a short break. Thank you for listening to the podcast. And remember to join the Facebook page, sign up for the Twitter and Instagram accounts. If you have a story you want to tell about Jerusalem, if you know someone who you think I should interview, please get in touch and let me know. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of the podcast. Thank you.
Yeah, and part of his project, at least part of the idea of a podcast, is also to revive figures. I mean, a city is made of its people, not just the buildings. So my point is really to try to give back, using a very sophisticated word, agency, to individuals. And, you know, some of them are well known, some others are not. And I think, you know, there is this process of getting back all of these figures, their contribution, but also what they left to us. And one of the things about Gad Frumkin, which you mentioned, and I learned through your work and also trying to read a little bit through the memoir, is the description of the streets of Jerusalem. Streets of Jerusalem that are also part of your work, that have been part of your work for quite a long time. Streets in Jerusalem had names, sometimes different names from the same street, sometimes had no names. But when the British arrived, one of the policy was to naming the streets. So I wanted to bring you here to this point of the question of naming streets around the city. How did that work, and what might be the consequences of, you know, assigning names to the streets of Jerusalem?
Okay, so this is, this is one of the very first things the British, the High Commissioner, does. So Herbert Samuel arrives in Palestine in the summer of 1920. And in August, he asks the Pro-Jerusalem Society, which is this organization headed by the governor, to name the streets and to put nameplates. So this is very much high on the agenda. I mean, this is the first High Commissioner of Palestine, and this is one of the very first things he thinks about. And the question, my question is why? Why is this a priority? And it's important to rule out, it's not because there's a pressing need for it on a pragmatic level. So people found, people sent letters to Jerusalem before there were street names, official street names, and the letters arrived in their destinations, and people found the addresses, etc. This is not about pragmatic need. This is a different kind of operation. So the need for that, I saw a number of reasons. One is that it's clear that Herbert Samuel thinks it about this as a way to map the city. So he thinks of the city as segregated between different religious communities. And in order to map who lives where, you need street name, and the street name will tell you. If it's a biblical prophet name, then probably it's a Jewish street. If it's Saladin, then it's probably a Muslim street. If it's a Crusader name, then maybe it's more an international, a place where foreigners live, Europeans and so forth. And that was, the British thought of calculating their policies on ethnic level and on spatial level, and that kind of enabled them to read the map very easily. They could look at the map and tell you where the Jews live, where the Muslims live, and so forth. You know, in the old city, they thought it's very simple. You have the quarters. Now, in reality, it wasn't the reality. You know, the four quarters of the city, the Jewish, Muslim, Armenian, and Christian, that's how they thought of it. But in reality, we know that this is not how people lived. I mean, we have Jews living in the Muslim quarter. We have Christians living in the Muslim quarter. I mean, this is a really European invention. But that's kind of part of the way of mapping the ethnic makeup of the city, and in some ways helping to make that map come true is through street names. Because, you know, if you come and your idea is that Jews in the old city live only in the Jewish quarter, then sooner or later that will also be true, because in a variety of ways the British helped that reality to take form. Now, that was one reason. The other reason is administrative, that they wanted addresses, because they wanted to be able to reach citizens or residents directly. The Ottomans worked a lot with local delegates, with local power. And when the Ottomans arrived for conscription, to see who should go to the military or not, and there's a committee that, you know, examines each man that is 18 years old and more. So it sits in one room, and the Mukhtar, the delegate, brings all the men to that room. They don't go along around the street looking for these people. So they don't need the addresses when the Ottomans, I mean, they were not to the same degree. The British didn't trust the Mukhtars, didn't trust the delegates. They wanted to be able to have the address. So they, when they need to arrest a certain Musa or a certain Moshe, they know that they live in Prophet Street 38. So for that, they need the address. And that is the British approach. Now, of course, it didn't work as they planned. I mean, a lot of streets remained not signposted. And houses that still didn't have numbers up until 1947, 48. But that at least was the intention. The philosophy was, we need the houses numbered, we need the street names, because we want to get to you. If you've done something wrong, you didn't pay your taxes, and everything that we need to know about you, we want your address. And this is not completely new. I mean, the Ottomans were moving in that direction, we should say. I mean, through census and through records, and the first numbering of the houses, as I say in the book, takes place in 1858. And the population hates it. And, you know, they know that when somebody comes and numbers your house, that probably is bad news for you. They want more taxes, they want you to go to the military and so forth. So that idea of disciplinary state power is something the population is quite suspicious of from the very beginning. And it does happen under Ottoman times, but the Ottomans didn't force it to the same degree. And especially what is very different between the two regimes, two systems of rule, is the ideological dimension. And this is, I think, the most important thing for the British. So the idea of ideologically transforming the city or enforcing their vision of the city on the city. We should remember that the British had very little money to spend. So they don't have the money to fund large building projects and large constructions and so forth. So that's not a contribution. I mean, you look at the public buildings that the British built in 30 years, not many of them. There's many important ones, but it's not a huge number. But street naming is a very easy, inexpensive way to change the city, to change the way the streets are called. And by changing the name of the street, you change the story that the city tells. And the story they wanted to tell is of Jerusalem as a biblical city, ancient city, holy city, segregated city, and a city that belonged to the ancient past. And you can see this in the names that are chosen, and that also the periods that are chosen are the periods that they were closest to. And that is the Bible, including the Christian Bible, and the Crusades. And these are, you know, the groups that get as many names as possible. There's hardly any Muslim names. And so that is very important. And I should stress is that the idea is, I'm not talking just about the old city. I'm talking about the new city, the parts that are really completely new. And the names of the street in the outside the walls, the way that people refer to them are usually names that either was the direction, you know, this is the street of Deir Yassin or Beit Safafa, a street of Fayed al-Alami that is after the mayor because the mayor paved the street, or street of the consulates, or streets of the Italian hospital. These are all kind of quite straightforward names. In a way, when you go in the UK, and that's the names that streets often have, you know, Lamb's Conduit, you know, these practical names that survived, not so much commemorative names. And that was also the names in Jerusalem. They changed all these mundane street names to biblical prophets' names and so forth, and by that changed the story, and that you connected to the how these street name plates looked like. They were ceramics in a way that was made very deliberately to resonate with the ceramic tiles of the Dome of the Rock. So in the same way that the decree was that all the buildings in Jerusalem had to be built now, at least from the external side, from stone, so they would echo the old city, in the same way the street names echoed the Dome of the Rock. And in both senses, we are talking about the sanctity of the holiest places, and you project it outwards to a city that was really largely modern. And this is the project of the street naming, which is effectively a very successful project, because a lot of the names take hold, and people call the streets by these names. So in that sense, it's illustrative of the way that the British took a city that was a city that's very much excited about the future, and made it a city that was about the past.
You just made a very important reference, talking about the question of the British. Many in the past used to argue that the British modernized Jerusalem, and it's only with the British that finally you have modern Jerusalem coming about. The British didn't build much, they didn't have the money, but they created the legal framework which allowed others to build the city. I heard you talking about the question of the British demodernizing the city. I was wondering if this is connected to just the question of the buildings, the question of the past. What does it mean to demodernize the city? I found this extremely fascinating and controversial, I would say, too.
Demodernizing means to basically create and entrench a view of the city that is, its meaning is about the ancient past. And it is a city that is beholden to its past, and a city which is about its sacred meaning and so forth. And I think that is, I mean, that is the British project there. It doesn't need to stop the development of the city. Of course, the city continued to develop and grow, but it means that development was done in a way that would serve that narrative. First, architecturally, so in terms of the shape, a city that is built of stone looks older than it is. And if it was built, if we had a city that is built of concrete and stucco and so forth, it would look very different. It would look much modern than it is today. And it would be much more difficult to make claims that this is the eternal city of Jerusalem. When you look at concrete, these claims sound a bit more hollow, I think. So I think that is crucial element there. They were very hostile initially to ideas of development. I mean, we can see this is in the concession for tramways and electricity, which they canceled. I mean, they canceled there was a Greek former Ottoman citizen who had the concession to establish tramways and electricity provision in Jerusalem from before the war. And this was a concession that the late mayor El-Hasseini was very proud of, but because of the war, it was delayed. And the British annulled almost immediately the tramways because they say it's something that is it doesn't belong to Jerusalem, and because it looks too new. And Governor Storrs was very proud of making this joke that, you know, the tramways will be laid on the dead body of the governor, he said. I mean, he used to say it in lectures in the US. When you look at someone like Ashby, I mean, Ashby comes to the city, Charles Ashby, who was the civic advisor to the governor. And he laughs at the idea that Jerusalem needs electricity. You know, he says, why do you need electricity in Jerusalem? You know, what industry? What industry? There's no industry. There's no need for industry. So Ashby has this idea of arts and crafts. So he has this idea of a medieval production that will somehow be revived and revitalized. And when you look at Ashby's plans for Jerusalem, it's all about these kind of Bedouin, trading Bedouins coming to the city and sleeping in caravanserais. Completely Orientalist vision that was out of touch with Jerusalem of the previous 50 years at least. So in a way, I mean, they came with this very, very Orientalist view of the city as an ancient and so forth city that its only way forward is to go back. We can see this with the clock tower that they did demolish. I mean, the clock tower that the Ottomans put on Jaffa Gate, and the clock tower is the new modernity. It's something that the residents were very proud of. They could look up and see the time and correct their own watches if they had one. And the British demolished it almost immediately. And this is because they want to remove time from Jerusalem, to make it timeless and to send it back to the past in the most clear way. So I think this is the project that I see there. And it's a project that is successful in some ways because this is the way we talk about Jerusalem today. I mean, as you said, most of the literature, you know, when it approaches Jerusalem, that's how it writes about the city. you know, a sectarian city, eternal city, ancient city, and so forth. Now, of course, it's a very ancient city, and of course, residents are proud of that. But if you look at Jerusalem, and the old city is less than 1% of the entire built environment. I mean, depends, of course, what boundaries you take. But the Jerusalem metropolitan area now stretches from Ramallah to Bethlehem, you know, south and north, and, you know, west of the city and east of the city. And of course, there's the green line goes in between all that. But if you look from the satellite, it's a huge metropolitan area. And most of it, oh, like 99% was built in the 20th century. So it's not an ancient city at all. I mean, the tiny nucleus of it is, but it's really a modern city. But that vision of the British means that we think of it as qualitatively different than, say, we think of Jaffa or Jaffa Tel Aviv or similar cities.
Yeah, when I think about that period of time and my own work about particularly the Stone of Jerusalem, I always wonder, what did they really think about it? I mean, there's also an aesthetic issue. I mean, the stone might look nice, but it created this homogeneous vision of the city, which I don't know. I mean, personally, it doesn't even look good, but as I said, this is a personal opinion about architecture. Not to mention the fact that there are economic issues because stone was more expensive than other materials. And obviously that brings about other questions about who could actually build the new city. I have one more question about your book before we actually come to the conclusion of the interview. But I found it fascinating in your work, you talk about graffiti at the Western Wall. The Western Wall is this, you know, very important, I would say, the very heart of the Jewish faith, at least in the contemporary era. And as myself, I dealt a little bit the Western Wall. I must say that I never came across the fact that there were graffitis there. I'm certainly aware of graffitis at the Holy Sepulchre. They've been there since the Crusader times. But I was not aware of these graffitis. And then browsing some old pictures, when actually still with the Maghrebi quarter was around, I actually could see the shade of them, but I never paid attention. So I must say thank to you because you brought this back to the attention. Can you tell us a little bit more about these graffitis?
So yes, I mean, I came across them in archival photographs and I was stunned. I never knew about this and I didn't realize what didn't make sense to me, and the historiography on the wall, and this is of course a site that much has been written about and so forth, there was almost no references to that in recent historiography, and it was referred to as a strange custom or as an ancient custom, which again didn't make sense because the photographs were from the early 20th century, and you can see these are not medieval inscriptions; these are recent inscriptions. So I start digging from there, and I could see that from various photographs and paintings that they were a very visible characteristic of the wall. People used to write their names. It's male names, as far as I can see. It's only men, and they were all over the wall. So the more I dug, I could see that this was not unique to this site. It's something that was done in Jewish holy sites, primarily tombs, but also synagogues and other places from the Roman period. So it really goes back thousands of years. And it's not unique to Jewish practices of pilgrimage. It's, you know, you can find it in Islam, also Christianity, the idea, and also pagan practices, the idea that you come to a place and you write your name, and that name will serve as a blessing for you or for your family and so forth. So this is a very ancient custom. From the late 19th century, early 20th century, you start seeing fascination with it, and you start seeing also condemnations of it, because suddenly there are people who say this is superstitious, improper custom that is not becoming of a place like the Western world. So they talk dismissively about this or something that should stop. But really around the 1929 riots and their aftermath, there's a huge amount of attention to the wall, and the inscriptions and the graffiti become part of that story. And after that, the custom is banned. And by that point, you see everybody, all the official bodies, I would say, are on board with this project of banning the graffiti. And that includes the British authorities. For them, this was a potentially explosive site where things can go out of control, and people writing on the wall is one way of things of getting out of control. For Zionist authorities, this was a national site, and by pilgrims just writing their names, this is disrespectful. For Jewish Orthodox modernizing authorities, this was again something disrespectful to a site that they understood religiously rather than nationally, unlike the Zionists. And for the Supreme Muslim Council, this was part of Zionist attempts to take over the wall and eventually take over Al-Aqsa Mosque. So they saw it as a Zionist kind of staking ownership over the site. So all of these authorities, they have different perspectives on the site, but they all are united in this idea that the custom should be prohibited. And what is interesting is that pilgrims continued to write their names on this place, but by then they would get arrested. There is police in the wall after 1930, and there's an official rabbi, which wasn't the case before 1929, and the police arrest. And sometimes the rabbi goes very quickly to the pilgrim and says, stop writing. But if not, then the police arrest them. And in some cases, I think someone was sent to prison for a month for writing. And the rabbi says, absolutely, go for it. You know, this is outrageous what people do in the world. So, I mean, for me, it was remarkable that something that was a very ancient custom overnight becomes something that is banned and is, you know, denounced and later on forgotten and erased, not just from the wall, but also from memory. And it also said something about the nationalization of this site and the fact that it became a site of conflict, but also this kind of fetishization of architecture. And I will mention Daniel Munch's book, Aesthetic Occupation, which is a very dense, complex book, but fascinating. And he talks about the fetishization of architecture and the holy sites as part of the conflict. You know, you move from a moment in which pilgrimage means hands-on engagement to a situation where holy architecture becomes something that is abstract almost, becomes an image. You can't touch it. You shouldn't touch it. I think that kind of changes in our approach to material culture is really fascinating. And it happens quite abruptly there. So I found it really, really fascinating.
One last question. We started a conversation talking about your work, and your work started with you walking around the city of Jerusalem, trying to think about text, trying to discover the city. If you were to walk around Jerusalem right now, on the spot, and you would name two of your favorite spots, which one they would be?
So, I mean, I think the first probably is easy. There's a compound in Abu Tur neighborhood, a Thori, you know, it's Arabic name. And it's a compound that belonged to the Greek Orthodox monastery. There's a bandstand in the middle of that I think served for bands in the British Mandatory period, or at least that's the neighborhood mythology. And it's very overgrown. There's lots of houses there that used to be, I think they started as half squatters or something. Or anyway, there's lots of illegal disputes about this compound. And as a result, it's underdeveloped, and it's one of the most beautiful views on the old city from there. It's not the promenade that you know, and it's also very beautiful, but it's also very perfect. This is not perfect. It's very overgrown, and the landscape is stunning. The other place generally is the streets of Nachlaot, and the areas of the market, and going to the Shuk, the Machne Yehuda market is really one of the pleasures of being in Jerusalem for me. Nachlaot is a very interesting patchwork of neighborhood, which are late Ottoman neighborhood set up by communal bodies and endowments, basically, initially for the services of different communities. So lots of Mizrahi communities, but also Ashkenazi communities. And it is a mix between the Ashkenazi Orthodox and gentrification and Mizrahi, and you have the synagogue, the great synagogue of the Jews from Aleppo and Kurdish Jews, etc. Lots of graffiti, hipster graffiti, and you know, stickers telling you to keep the Shabbat and to give money for tzedakah, and just random stuff. And I think that randomness is what I like. So it's this mishmash. And of course, I mean, Nachlaot, if you look at the British planners and administrators, in the 1920s, they hated Nachlaot and the place near the Midrachov, forgot the name. But these kind of older Ottoman Jewish neighborhoods, they thought they were slums. They reminded them of the East End, and they wanted to demolish them as soon as possible. Today, of course, they are celebrated as this kind of old, beautiful Jerusalem. But for them, for the British, they were slums. For the Zionist newcomers, the ones that came in the 20s and 30s, again, they were slums. You look at how they write about them, and it's with contempt often. They kind of say, this is Arab, you know, although these are Jewish neighborhoods. But I mean, today they are cherished as, you know, beautiful, and the character of Jerusalem, and that's the place to go and eat falafel or kube soup or whatever. So that's kind of the, yeah, between those places, that's my Jerusalem.
This was Yair Wallach, senior lecturer at SOAS and author of A Sitting Fragment, Urban Text in Modern Jerusalem. Yair, thank you so much.
Thank you, Roberto, for this podcast and for the wonderful series of fascinating podcasts that you've produced so far.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Jerusalem Unplugged. I hope you enjoyed it. And remember to join our Facebook page as well as our Twitter and Instagram accounts. Feel free to write your comments. Let me know stories about Jerusalem. Get in touch. And remember, enjoy, share, subscribe. Thank you.